8-1, Clark County Association of School Administrators versus Clark County School District. Good morning.
Seem to be missing somebody.
Are we missing somebody? Elizabeth, did we get it?
Why don't you move over there?
I was not planning on arguing
for both sides. No.
He's here. He's on here.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Here we go.
Good morning. Okay, Council, are we ready to proceed? And did you want to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
My name is Christopher Humes. I represent the Clark County Association of School Administrators and Professional Technical Employees, which I'll refer to as CASA during this oral argument. May it please the court. This case, at the heart of it, is about a principal's statutory right to select the best possible educator to teach his or her students at his school. This law was enacted for the betterment of children's education and not CCSD's contract negotiations. The lower court's order, however, did not account for this and is reversible on three primary grounds. First, the lower court made erroneous findings of facts and misinterpreted the law when it authorized a teacher lottery which placed ineffective teachers at local school precincts over their objections, elevating CCSD's labor relations over the benefit of a student's education. Second, and more problematic, the lower court misinterpreted the law when it decided that CCSD's labor contracts were superior to the unambiguous plain text and spirit of the school reorganization law, allowing CCSD and the other bargaining units to contract around the statute's requirements. And third, the lower court committed reversible error when specifically ordering motions to dismiss pursuant to Rule 12b-5, but then abandoning the well-settled standard of review by making factual determinations outside the four corners of CASA's petition and drawing inferences in favor of the moving party. Now in 2016, the Nevada legislature enacted AB 469, Assembly Bill 469. And it did this, and this is codified in the statute itself, because the Nevada legislature had found that CCSD had become entrenched and inflexible in a bureaucratic operational paradigm. And to move away from this model, the Nevada legislature sought to create an autonomous, site-based decision-making model. Now, in furtherance of this goal, the Nevada legislature commanded the CCSD superintendent to transfer the authority of many powers to the schools themselves, making them autonomous, site-based models. This included giving these schools their own local board of governance called school organizational teams, giving these schools budgetary powers they had never had before. And crucially, for the purposes of this case, allowed the schools to select their own teachers, their own staff, and their own administrators. Now, when AB 469 was enacted, as commented by the superintendent of the State Board of Education multiple times, CCSD's labor agreements were in violation of the statute because provisions in those agreements allow teachers and staff to select the schools that they're going to work at, not the other way around like the statute requires. Now, in response to the state superintendent's direction, who, it should be noted, under the statute has the authority to take all actions to enforce this law, CASA amended its agreement. CASA agreement complies with AB 469. In fact, CCSD has touted CASA's agreement as a model of compliance. But unfortunately, the other bargaining units, the teachers union, the support staff union, they've refused to amend their agreements. And CCSD has gone along with it, executing agreement after agreement after agreement. The problem is that given the structure of the law, there is an inevitability that out of the 18,000 teachers in CCSD, some of those teachers just won't be selected by any school, largely due to ineffectiveness. And this is a problem for CCSD because it has no solution. It's never amended its agreement. It has no process on how to treat these teachers that are employed by CCSD but not selected by a school, whether it be going to central office to receive retraining or becoming a substitute. They've never amended their agreements to establish a process. So in order to fix this self-created labor relation issue, CCSD invented a teacher lottery where these teachers, these unselected teachers that were passed over by every local school precinct in the district, were going to be raffled off. And the lucky school that won these unselected teachers would be forced to take them over their objections. This is plainly violative of the law, and in response, CASA filed a petition for writ relief at the lower court.
Before you get too further down the road of your argument, let's stop there for a moment and tell us how it is that the district court erred by finding that you had adequate remedies at law such that the writ should be denied and you shouldn't be pursuing declaratory relief or letting the EMRB go to final decision and filing a PJR, things of that nature.
Yes, Your Honor. Declaratory relief is not coercive, and CCSD has demonstrated that it will not comply with the law, going as far as disobeying direct orders from the state superintendent multiple times throughout the years, the person that has the authority to enforce the law. And addressing the EMRB has stated itself that it does not have jurisdiction to interpret NRS Chapter 388G. And the other party's argument that their bargaining agreements somehow control over the statute is predicated solely on language within 388G. NRS 388G 610, subsection 2 says the superintendent shall transfer the authority to the local school precincts.
Along with the declaratory relief, didn't you have injunctive relief potentially as well?
Your Honor, there injunctive relief does exist, but if there was declaratory relief and injunctive relief and they had to be combined to provide an adequate remedy, almost every petition for writ relief at a district court could be alternatively filed or fashioned in such a manner. And writ relief is available. And so to hold that this patchwork combination of remedies could defeat the issuance of a really
kind of an extraordinary remedy when no other remedy exists?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if you've got declaratory relief and potentially injunctive relief, why isn't that an adequate remedy?
Currently, as it stands, CASA has no adequate remedy, because even if those two remedies were combined, and the court's order goes on to state that it allows CASA to refile its petition or a complaint for declaratory relief. This was only allowed after pages upon pages of erroneous facts and inaccurate legal interpretations. And so to the extent that CASA now has some sort of adequate remedy or relief, it will likely be hamstrung in any future proceedings unless this court vacates those findings because possibly of res judicata concerns. So while CASA did not have an adequate remedy when it filed, but it surely does not have one now, given the court's many reversible errors outlined in its findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Mr. Humes, let me sort of follow up on that last piece about the current status, because it's my understanding the policy, this so-called lottery, as you're referring to it, ended in December of 2020. So I guess what has been happening since, and why is there still an issue now?
Yes, Your Honor. So while in 2020, the teacher lottery was occurring, this case more correctly could be framed as what CCSD does during the transfer and reassignment periods, which occur twice a year in a school year. And so since the teacher lottery, CCSD has taken the even more drastic step of stating that there will be no lottery. What will happen is that we will now assign you a teacher. So there is absolutely no selection. CCSD, pursuant to its non-compliant provisions in its bargaining agreement, every transfer and reassignment period goes to teachers and says, here's your teacher. You don't get a selection. This is who you are forced to take. And that is why this case is still moot, or is not moot, and is still relevant, because CCSD continues every year, twice a year, to deprive principals of their statutory right to select teachers that best fit their school's plans of operation.
So doesn't that only happen if that principal has not selected teachers to fill all the teacher slots? Like there's open teacher slots that have not been filled by the principal if that's happening, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but there's no selection. There is no ability to select a teacher. And so those principals should be afforded to go to a list and select those teachers. And these vacancies need to be filled by teachers that will best support a principal's plan of operations. There's nothing in the statute that allows CCSD to come in and forcibly place a teacher. CASA submits that there needs to be some sort of conversation, because reading the statute as a whole, these principals have a statutory obligation to select staff and teachers that best support their plan of operation. And so if presented with a teacher who may not be effective, like in the teacher lottery, or simply may not support that school's plan of operation, the principal should have the opportunity to interview that applicant and select that applicant. It shouldn't.
Because you agree that the principals can't operate in contravention of the collective bargaining. Do you agree with that? Or not?
The principals cannot operate.
Cannot select in a way that's inconsistent with the collective bargaining agreement. Do you agree with that or not?
I do not agree with that, Your Honor.
So if CCSD transferred their power, they can only transfer the power they have. Is that right? So it's your position that the principals' statutory right to pick somehow has changed everything before. So it affects the collective bargaining agreement and all those things. So they have more power than CCSD did to place teachers. Is that how you read that?
Based on the legislative history, Your Honor, it has been widely accepted view that the authority that has been transferred is CCSD's authority to pick teachers. In fact, other places within the same chapter directs when parties should bargain pursuant to Chapter 288, but notably, there is no direction in that statute itself. And this interpretation has been endorsed by the state superintendent, who again has the authority to enforce this law. The attorney general has provided commentary also supporting this interpretation. The very first bill that...
Council, doesn't the legislative history in fact indicate that they were not intending to limit the effectiveness of collective bargaining agreements, that they weren't superseding them?
Yeah, I believe you're speaking to one comment that was made at the tail end of an advisory committee meeting. And that conversation...
Are there other comments where they said, yeah, you won't have to follow collective bargaining agreements anymore? Because I don't think I've been pointed to anything like that.
No, Your Honor, there is no explicit statement that you don't have to follow collective bargaining agreements anymore, but there is nothing saying that those collective bargaining agreements do not have to comply with the law that is written. A contract should not drive the scope of a law. The law should drive the scope of a contract.
So that would be for going forward with collective bargaining agreements. What about whatever was already in place?
So that presents this scenario where a principal who is not even a member of the bargaining units, they're having their statutory rights bargained by other parties. These administrators don't have any power to bargain anything in those contracts. And so this interpretation leaves these principals waiting in the wings for other bargaining units to establish what their power is. I'm sorry, my time is up.
You can finish your answer to her question.
For the Nevada legislature to create this extremely complex system of laws formed to govern and reorganize CCSD, to only then allow CCSD and the other bargaining units to shape it and modify it through the process of collective bargaining, is an absurd interpretation, because why would the legislature go to such trouble in the first place? Thank you.
Okay, and we chewed into your time pretty good. I'm going to give you 2 minutes to rebut. Did you have a question?
Sorry, I did, Chief. The length of the discussion, I think, prevented you from getting to your 12B5 argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I think when we talk about the adequacy of the remedy, I'm interested in that particular portion of your argument. So could you briefly outline that, because I've asked respondents to address it, because it seems to me we're dealing with also an appeal on the motion.
Welcome to Zoom. Please press pound, then enter meeting ID 8406268651006. Please enter the meeting passcode followed by the pound sign.
Save court.
You are in the meeting now.
Recording in progress.
Allegation in the complaint, but apparently now you're saying the court didn't use the complaint. Instead, it determined there was an issue of law as between substitute and licensed teachers. I wonder if you could point me to that part of the court's order.
So the district court, and maybe I'm not getting my point across, Your Honor, and I apologize, but...
Well, is it there or not? It's pretty simple. You've made an argument here. I just want to know if it's there or not.
So in the specific factual part, not that I can find, but in the findings and conclusions towards the end, specifically paragraph 18 on findings and conclusions, it says that the court further finds and concludes that the declarations submitted, which were of the individual principals, stating their facts where they chose substitutes over the licensed teachers, that the declarations failed to sufficiently show how the declarants plan to meet their obligations under 0.6104.
So the argument counsel made on the 12B5 is that the district court judge is now engaging in fact-finding as to that issue, which is not permissible in a 12B5 motion. How do you address that?
So I believe it's, there was a statutory interpretation of how the district court interpreted subsection 4. And based off of the allegations, what the court is saying is that there is a failure to state a claim in the manner in which the statute is being interpreted. So it's not a fact, an impermissible fact finding. The court is applying the facts as alleged in the petition that they wanted to select substitute over licensed good standing teachers. And so the question turns on to the greatest extent possible. And so how the district interprets this provision is that the facts as outlined in the petition and in the declarations provided attached to the petition are insufficient to demonstrate how they were trying to satisfy to the greatest extent possible based off of the court's interpretation.
Ms. Nichols, I'm sorry to interrupt, but let me just clarify a couple quick things, I think, before I let your colleagues get a little bit of time. This case was begun with a petition as opposed to a complaint. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the petition had attached to it the declarations that are being referenced in the court's order, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. And so under 12B5, it's my understanding that courts are allowed to consider evidence that's attached to and relied on in that initial pleading. Is that your understanding?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And unless the court has any further questions, I will pass it.
Okay. Thank you. Please the Chief Justice and the court, Adam Levine for the Clark County Education Association. Notwithstanding any fact-finding by the district court, the petition was properly dismissed and the district court properly declined to exercise its discretionary jurisdiction to hear a writ petition. And the reason the district court got it correct and declined to exercise its discretion was that there were plain, speedy, adequate remedies in the ordinary course of law. As this court has stated, extraordinary relief should be extraordinary. And in this particular case, CASA utilized its writ petition to circumvent the ongoing proceedings before the EMRB. All CASA had to do was request a hearing where the EMRB laid out its interpretation of the bargaining obligation and said, we reserve the right to change or modify our decision after a hearing.
All CASA had to do was request a hearing. If it changed the EMRB's mind, then the district and CCEA would have the obligation to pursue judicial review. If CASA did not change the EMRB's mind, then they had the ability to pursue judicial review. That was an adequate remedy. In fact, they did file prematurely a petition for judicial review and then dismissed it in agreement with the EMRB's counsel that it was not yet a final decision in a contested case. They also had...
Is there yet a final decision in that EMRB case?
They have not, because they appealed this rather than go back to the EMRB. They had an adequate remedy through the grievance mechanism of their collective bargaining agreement with the district, which expressly incorporated AB 469, which we sometimes refer to as now Chapter 388G, and by doing so, made any dispute in the manner in which the district placed teachers squarely within the definition of a grievance, and it could have gone to an arbitrator. Policy, public policy, has long established that arbitration of disputes between labor organizations and management should be resolved by arbitration and not the courts. Finally, as the district
court... Mr. Levine, sorry. Why aren't they correct that at least when, you know, even if there's the right of the school district to continue to collectively bargain regarding these issues, aren't they right that they should not be negotiating future agreements that are contrary to the statutes that are in place, giving the principals the authority to select the teachers?
If that were the case, that they were, that the district was negotiating contracts that are incompatible with the statute, but that is not the case, and that is not the position of the district, nor is it the position of the CCEA. I mean, obviously, there is a concept in labor law, which there are subjects of mandatory bargaining, permissive bargaining, and prohibited bargaining. If they believed that the district and its other organizations were engaged in prohibited bargaining, then their remedy is to go before the EMRB and not to seek extraordinary relief where extraordinary circumstances are not present and they have a plain, speedy, adequate remedy in the ordinary course.
Where is the fact that the ERMB said that it lacks jurisdiction to interpret 388G?
The EMRB frequently says we can only interpret the bargaining obligation. I see this frequently with the EMRB. But the EMRB's interpretation of 288 does not stop it from looking at 388G and determining whether there is an inconsistency with Chapter 288. And they found that the statutes can be construed harmoniously. And that was also the conclusion of the district court. And they surely can be construed harmoniously. If you look at the bargaining statute, 288.150, subsection 9 talks about the management right to select for turnaround schools, which are provided for under Chapter 388. In the same legislative session that AB 469 was passed, the legislature modified NRS 288.152U, which is the statute that makes policies for the transfer and reassignment of teachers a subject of mandatory bargaining. They didn't exclude large school districts. They could have. And when the legislature passes statutes in the same legislative session, they are particularly to be construed as being harmonious. The legislature, if it wanted to exclude large school districts from bargaining policies for the reassignment of teachers, they could have expressly provided for it. They could have said, except in a large school district as defined by NRS Chapter 388G, policies for the transfers. They didn't do so. They left it in place consistent with the legislative history that was previously referenced in the question about the intent of the legislature. Finally, let me conclude with, we believe that the matter is moot now based on the new regulations. Not only do the new regulations permit the school district to place a licensed teacher for a substitute if the local school precinct fails to demonstrate the teachers in good standing have been selected to fill, in other words, to the greatest extent possible, the new regs expressly give that right to the school district, and if a principal is aggrieved, there's a brand new remedy beyond the three that I have already identified, which is it is now subject to a grievance procedure established under the regulations. So while there were plain, speedy, adequate remedies in the ordinary course that existed when they filed this petition to circumvent the EMRB, those remedies are now even expanded. A writ petition was not the appropriate course to go. Unless the court has any questions for me, I'm going to turn it over to the representative for the ESEA.
Okay. And I gave your opposing colleague 2 additional minutes for rebuttal. I'll offer you 2 additional minutes as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, good morning. Frank Flaherty on behalf of intervener respondent ESEA. It cannot be seriously disputed that a 12b-5 motion is an appropriate procedural vehicle to dispose of a writ petition. Although in a conventional 12b-5 analysis, we might assume the facts as pled by the plaintiff to be true, that's not applicable or appropriate in a case where we have someone seeking a writ of mandate because we don't assume the law as pled by a petitioner to be true. The district court has to determine what the law is. Thus, CASA's protest notwithstanding, it was entirely appropriate for the district court to delve into the merits of its writ petition. Extraordinary relief should be extraordinary. The right to mandamus relief must be clear. Mandamus against an officer is only appropriate when there is a present definite duty imposed upon that officer by law. The problem for CASA is that neither the district court nor the EMRB agreed with its statutory conflict assertion or that there was anything at all clear or definite about how you apply AB 469 where that statute intersects with union rights under NRS Chapter 288. There's nothing supporting the notion that the legislature intended AB 469 to divest CCSD employees of collective bargaining rights. In its latest argument in support of that notion, CASA is now citing NRS 388G 120E and F for the first time in its appellate briefs, arguing that because in that statute adopted in 2007, the legislature required that the manner by which teachers and staff at empowerment schools are hired and selected must be negotiated. And then 10 years later, in AB 469, when it added an entirely new subchapter to 288G, it didn't use that same or similar language. They're arguing that that dissimilarity somehow signals legislative intent to divest or diminish collective bargaining rights. But the problem is that the selection and hiring of teachers and staff, that has never been a mandatory subject of bargaining under NRS 288-150. So 388G-120 actually constitutes an expansion of collective bargaining. Apparently, when the legislature had empowerment in mind at empowerment schools, it thought it wanted to give teachers and staff at those schools some say in the selection and hiring of their colleagues. The conflict, or the better word, maybe friction, between NRS 288-150 and 388G-610 isn't really about the selection of teachers and staff. It's about stuff that comes up afterwards when you have a surplus situation, involuntary transfers, reductions in force, employees returning from a long-term leave of absence. NRS 388G-610 sub 3 provides a list of items that CCSD, not the local school precincts, remains responsible for. And the very first item on that list is collective bargaining. ESEA and CCEA have negotiated comprehensive, somewhat complex contract language with CCSD that provides procedures for reductions in force, surplus, involuntary transfers, long-term leaves of absence. And those procedures are absolutely necessary for the operation of both the local school precinct and the Clark County School District. It was a leave of absence scenario, not the teacher lottery, that was the genesis.
I think you're out of time now.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. Let me ask my colleagues if they have any questions for you.
Okay.
Any questions for them? Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Your Honor, just a point of clarification. Do I have 2 minutes or 3 minutes?
2 minutes.
Okay. To start with ESEA's argument, they notably stated a conflict exists. They tried to term it as friction, but it is a conflict. And CCEA's argument that you have to look to some sort of subsections within NRS Chapter 288 and declare that the legislature is required to pass some sort of amendment to that statute, that is not the rules that this court follows when determining in a conflict which statute controls. The rules are the newer statute must control, the more specific statute must control, and AB 469 is both the newer and the more specific statute. And so therefore, under the rules of this court, because of this conflict, AB 469 should control. And going back to CCSD's claims that these teachers were, or these principals were selecting substitute teachers, that is false. These principals were following CCSD's rules. They were provided access to the human online portal where they go to select all of their teachers vetted by CCSD, provided by CCSD. They were following the rules. And when they picked those teachers and selected them, that's when CCSD came in and said, well, since you have to use the short-term designation as substitute because these teachers don't have licenses yet, we're going to make sure that you don't have access to the teacher that you selected. You must take the unselected teacher that was passed over by every local school precinct. As far as the regulation making this moot, I'd like to point out that the regulation allows the principal to select teachers. It requires CCSD to provide a full comprehensive list of every teacher available that fits the requirements. And it does not discriminate between teachers selecting teachers at the start of a school year or during an assignment and reassignment transfer period. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for him? All right, thank you. Council, we appreciate the arguments and your briefing here today. The matter will stand submitted. Yeah, we'll just stay in place. And the court will stand in recess for a moment.